Hello and welcome to the Leadership and Insurance Podcast. I'm your host, Gavin Savage, and on this special edition of the show, we are joined by a very special guest who some many of the listeners should know. Alex Bond, welcome to your show.
Thanks, Gavin. I can't tell you how weird that was to hear you say that. I wanted to jump in and say, "Hang on, that's the wrong name." But well, thanks for having me on my show. Really appreciate it.
Well, before we get into many of the topics discussed, I think for those that may not know, could you kindly introduce yourself, who you are, the business you work for, and why we should listen to you today?
I know that's you getting revenge for seeing me do that to a few people on a panel once. So my name's Alex Bond. I'm founder and managing partner of FinPro Search Partners, mostly known as FinPro. FinPro is the executive recruitment brand for the insurtech industry. As far as I know it, and we've never been corrected on this, we're the only insurtech specific recruitment business in the world, which is quite an unusual thing. Why should you listen to me? Well, that's probably related to above. I used to work for a carrier. I've been in the insurance industry as a search and talent consultant now for 17 years. And I've been running FinPro in its current guise for the last four. And we only do insurtech. So if you don't listen to me about anything else, that's absolutely fine. But if we're talking about insurtech and insurtech talent, then I'd like to think I'm well positioned to help you out.
Awesome. Awesome. And I guess as a very rudimentary first question, could you define what insurtech means to you? And as a business being FinPro, why is it important to be insurtech specific for you?
Yeah, that is a good question. It's actually a question that gets asked. It gets asked a lot by venture, actually. We have this conversation when we're talking to VCs quite a lot about, how do we define insurtech? And yeah, to a certain extent, I don't know if it's that helpful a term. I think, firstly, insurtech likes to sort of believe, the current guys of insurtech likes to believe that it's only been around in the last kind of like 6 or 7 years, but then you've had technology businesses serving the insurance industry for a long time. And some of those businesses are very large and very successful, and they'd probably be quite annoyed about the idea that it's insurtech. But I think how we define it today is a spectrum. So insurtech is a lazy term really to cover a bit of a cover all. And for us, that's everything from like digital insurers, the likes of kind of Lemonade and GetSafe, through to kind of digital MGAs, digital brokers, and everyone that's sort of essentially revolutionizing the traditional distribution models and the traditional insurance incumbents, all the way through to kind of like SaaS businesses in the insurtech space. So those are businesses that typically serve the traditional insurance space, and those are either kind of like, underwriting workbenches or analytics tools that help to, drive innovation and profitability within the insurance industry. And then we kind of move a little bit further on that to things that are insurtech adjacent, where there is a very large insurance element, not necessarily their only vertical. And, I think of a business like Climate X, for example, that, insurance is a big vertical for them, but it's not the only one. So that's how we loosely define insurtech. Why is it important? I think the key thing when you're coming to any recruitment business or any talent business is how much does that business understand what you're looking for? How much does that business have a really strong network? And how quickly and efficiently can they access that network? So I started out my career in insurance claims. And for a large part of my career in the recruitment industry, I just did insurance claims. I did that for about 6 years. And you get to the point where you come out of a briefing with a client and you probably know the top four names on your list. You can't do that if you say, right, I am going to be covering fintech. You can't do that even if you say insurance. So it's important to kind of really focus. And I think why it's important in insurtech, and insurtech, as we say, is still very, very broad. There's something different about insurtech, which probably doesn't happen in more established industries, in that most of our clients are venture backed. Most of sort of anything from Series C through to Series B, maybe beyond, as we sort of are hitting a more maturation. They need that kind of startup scale up mentality. And our job is to find not just the rudimentary skill sets, like you might need a broker, you might need an actuary, you might need a VP of engineering, you might need a product person, but it's also to get the person that's going to fit with inside the kind of stage and scaling speed that you're at. And I think that's where we really, really add value. And I think that's why that's important.
Nice. And I think you probably answered that to some degree, because for those that maybe don't know, Alex and I work together on the recruitment side, and I lead up all things tech. But when I joined, it was all geared towards insurtechs. But yes, we focus on the insurance industry. But I think, as I say, you've probably answered it a little bit, and that why is it important? But why don't we, or why do we not now work with large insurers and brokers? Because, well, I mean, there's more hiring to be done there, surely. They have more money to spend. Like, yeah.
It's a question I battle with, I think, as you know. I think that's a little bit reflective of us, right? I think I like to be close to the beating heart of the business. And the beating heart of a business is that founding team, it's that leadership team. In the same way that when people want roles, one of the appeals of working for an insurtech or a startup or a scale up is that you're probably closer to the decision making. Things happen faster. And for us, as a relatively small business, like we need to work closely with the client. And there's two reasons for that. One, honestly, it's a personal preference. I think that's just more enjoyable. I genuinely feel like in a partner to the business. Because we're a function that exists in every business. If you're a big enough business, you probably have a talent team, a recruitment team. It doesn't mean you won't work with external providers, but essentially you've got someone managing that kind of workflow. We're really providing that for those smaller businesses. So, from a kind of just personal enjoyment perspective, kind of fulfillment in my role, I want to work more closely with them. But the second side of it is related, is that bigger businesses, you have these layers. So you have procurement teams and you have recruitment teams and talent teams. And that's great. And the best ones are kind of really collaborative. And you know this, you've been doing this a long time, is that the best of those are really, really good, and you still feel like a partner. But quite often in the bigger businesses, there's a huge cavern between you and actually the end client, and that is the person that is making that hiring decision, and that just makes my life so difficult. And difficulty we don't mind, but I'm judged on my ability to deliver on a remit. And if I can't get close enough to my hiring manager, and I don't mean one sit down hour meeting where we have a briefing call and that's it, never to be seen again, and then work with the recruit team. I need a constant back and forth. I need unfiltered feedback, because being truthful, I probably have more experience than the person I'm passing the information through. And I want that unfiltered information. What's good? What's bad about that candidate that you've interviewed? What am I missing that's not allowing us to deliver? And as and the more barriers you get there, the harder that is. And I've told this story a few times. The other thing is that I didn't find a lot of what was being done there very interesting. Once you've placed a head of claims of a Lloyd's syndicate, you've placed the head of claims at a Lloyd's syndicate. Once you've placed a head of offshore energy, which is always the one I talk about, because I ended up doing four searches in the same year for the same class of business, everyone in that sector. Now it's good money, but we know, and the insurtech industry says that itself, it's not all about the money. If it's all about the money, why aren't people staying in insurance businesses, incumbent businesses, and just riding that out? Because there's incredible careers to be had there, and great money to be earned. But I think it's the challenge as much as anything. I think I could go on forever about that, because I think it does come back to that thing. I am an entrepreneur. This is the business I started, and most of it was because I wanted something more from those relationships. And I think you have to accept that when you're dealing with larger organizations, you're not going to get that. The only thing I'd extrapolate out of that is that that is starting to shift, as you know. We are starting to see really innovative businesses building, not just innovation functions, but even like whole standalone businesses that run parallel. Now, those businesses are exciting, but as with all innovation teams, that only works if they have the autonomy. And that means autonomy to choose a supplier, such as us. And that means autonomy to make those decisions, such as kind of working with us really closely. And in those businesses, we are starting to work. So I think that will start to shift and change as we go on.
Because yeah, we are seeing a lot more investment on the technology front. Certainly I am, and you yourself. But you highlighted the challenges, the inherent challenges of working with large organizations. Like, what for you are because it sounds like the early stage startup world is easy to work with, and you and I both know it's not easy, but it's just more, there's
No.
more value adds. We can have deeper relationships. But what are the unique challenges for you of working with early stage businesses?
Because I did paint a picture there that made it sound like it was all roses and we're all slipping along holding hands. And we're definitely not. I think early stage businesses, it's almost flipping the conversation upside down. For everything that's frustrating about the rigor and structure of a really established, incumbent carrier, for example, you don't have that quite often within a startup business. Now, startup businesses are not the same. They're as unique as a fingerprint, and they're essentially the multiple fingerprints of the people involved. And some of these people are very kind of experienced business people, but they might be quite inexperienced entrepreneurs. They also might be actually just inexperienced business people as well, which is particularly true of venture-backed businesses where maybe they come from another industry and they joined insurance. So I think the challenge is usually one of education. That's the biggest gap. And that could be education around process. What is an acceptable process? I mean, you have this in your world all the time. I see this quite a lot, is that, six stages is not acceptable. Because you're asking for too much of someone's time. How do we make that shorter but still effective? Compensation is the bugbear of everyone. Yes, we're really passionate about your startup, and you're really passionate about your startup. And yes, you've got equity, but people have bills to pay. So you can't fight the market if a certain job profile or personal profile with certain job skill sets pays X in the market, you can't do X minus 25%. And if you do, you have to accept that you're targeting a very small kind of range of people. So I think education around like things like process, education around the recruiting, the natural kind of flow of recruiting, and then just the sort of quite often a sort of expectation management is much, much harder. Working with a big incumbent, they'll go, yeah, I know this is going to take a long time. I know you're not going to be able to work miracles. Sometimes they even go, I know the compensation isn't where I need to go, and I know what that means. Whereas, there's such passion from venture-backed businesses. Sometimes it is like it's a list of demands that we know on the outset is going to be very, very difficult to hit. And so that expectation management is difficult. Particularly in terms of kind of numbers, because something risky, we talk about risk curves all the time. I'm quite unique and I think about this all the time, and it wasn't the way life was planned to be, but I'm a single guy and I'm 42 years old and I don't have any children. So I can take inherent risk. Like it doesn't matter to me that I work for a business that may go under. But if you're got two kids in college and you're an insurance executive in the peak of your career, you probably can't join some seed round startup for 50% of your salary. So you've sort of got this bell-shaped curve that people could take risk early in their career and people could take risk at the later end. And actually, quite often what we're looking for is the people in that middle, in the peak of their career. So it's managing all of those kind of expectations and enthusiasm into something that is achievable. That is almost without a doubt the biggest challenge.
Super interesting. And Yeah, for anyone that's hiring in technology, as Alex said, six stages, three tech tests with 100% pass rate is not okay.
I think that testing's really interesting as well, in the it's so binary. And I kind of get it, like especially in tech, you can either code the thing or you can't code the thing. But we live in a world where tests are a fraction of time in someone's career. And I'm not suggesting that for anyone, I would not bend the bar on quality in my team, as like I'm really strict about that. That's why we're not as big as we potentially should be. But we talked about this last night. You and I both looked at an AI-driven recruiting tool, and one of the things that I thought about was it's amazing, but there's a lot of kind of automatic discounting of XYZ people for different reasons that you and I know some of the magic is around the edges. Those people that get 92% on the tech test and you should be 100, but their value to the business in terms of kind of like the team, for example, that person that's like a absolute cheerleader for enthusiasm, whereas you get the person's 100%, but they're actually quite toxic in the team environment. There's so much to it that any binary method, I think, is sometimes you've got to say, what is our variance here? And it happens more in tech than others, but I'm seeing it now. I'm working with quite a few businesses in the Bay Area, and it's got that Silicon Valley kind of mentality where people are giving personality questionnaires, and they're making it a binary yes or no. And I'm like, then all you're creating is groupthink. But again, it comes back to that thing. It's an immature application of a tool that helps in recruitment without a kind of wide view context. So, yeah, I mean, that's where we come in. But yeah, six stages, three tech tests, which that needs to go in the bin of 2023, and 2024 needs to not have that.
It's certainly out for me. I mean, we see it less and less, but yeah, you've got to test the technical skills, but I think attitudes, activity and a willingness to learn should, if someone comes in at 92, 93%, I'm a believer in putting that person progressing that. But you kind of you've highlighted for the past 10 minutes I guess the relationships that we have with founders and startups and generally the startup community, particularly within InsurTech, given all these businesses are, of course, venture backed, I think it'd be great to get an insight into, defining your relationship and maybe the FinPro business's relationship with the VC community and the investors and why that's so important for us to be closely linked with them.
So I wish I could be really clever and remember a paper that someone wrote about venture-backed businesses, but essentially, and someone quoted it on my own podcast, which I've now forgotten. I can't remember who said it or whatever. But I think the reason we build such a close relationship with VC, and it's not something we actually sought out proactively to start with. I was quite naive into venture-backed businesses because I'd always worked with pretty large insurers or brokers, and yes, there were some independent brokers, but they were usually pretty large businesses. But a lot of the businesses were like publicly traded companies, and it's a very different funding environment. But when you're looking at venture-backed businesses, when you're looking at a kind of startup scale-up world, there's two things you need to build a business. And you need fuel, which is your money, and you need people. I'm sure it's fuel and fire, but I'm horribly wrong on that. But I know, you know what? It's gonna be fuel and oxygen or something like that. It's about making fire. But yeah, anyway, essentially, you need people and money. You need people and money, and you need talented people, and you need enough cash. So it's a very close relationship. And because we've proven, and I always say not to pitch on this, so I'm not gonna go into it. It's just like we have 100% success rate. There is not a single search that we've taken on we've not delivered on. And we do that in this environment. So if you're a venture business, a fund, and you're investing in a company and they need these really important hires to get them going, You want to have a close relationship with a recruitment business that can deliver on that. Look, there's loads of excellent recruits businesses out there. Like, we're not unique in having that such high hit rate. We can get on to why you should retain people versus not in a bit if it comes up. But like, having a good relationship with people that can help your investment is part of what being a VC is all about. You know, I very much came into my relationships with VC, going, oh, they just write checks. And I know so many venture people now, and they wish they only wrote checks, you know, but, well, they probably don't, but, you know, they wish it was as easy as that. But it is about helping them with distribution. It's like sometimes helping them get like carrier partners. It's if they're sort of trying to build an MGA model, for example, it's introducing them to people that are in their network that might join the business. It's introducing them to advisors. It's giving advice. It's being a sounding board. And sometimes that's introducing them to people that can provide you with talent. So that relationship is really collegiate. It's very much like we're all on the same team, because they want their investment to grow and get the returns. We want their businesses to grow because they'll need to hire more people. And that it's so it's a really symbiotic relationship. At least that's the way I see it. I hope they see it the same way. But they seem to invite us to enough soirees and parties, so I'd like to think that they do, but yeah, it's not what I thought at the outset. But I think what's interesting and what's sometimes misunderstood is that, you know, VCs only can give advice. Once they write that check, it's the entrepreneur that runs that business is still making those decisions. It's not private equity; they can't dictate. So, you know, it has to be a collegiate thing. You have to be in constant communication. Because you have to be the right fit for their investment as well. And sometimes we're not. You know, we had a business recently, we've done all of their hiring. And they had a very specific hire that they needed. We weren't the right pick. So we stayed on the bench for that one, and someone else was introduced by VC. And firstly, I got my nose out of joint about it. And then I thought, do you know what? They're giving the right advice there. So yeah, it's really collaborative. And their relationships are really cherished. Because there's some of the most kind of respectful partnership sounding board, interesting conversations that I have with the VC community.
Just at the end there, you kind of mentioned around VCs being misunderstood, like kind of flipping that on you and us as recruiters, you know, talking about 100% success rate. And you mentioned again previously the AI tool we were discussing last night. Thank God you never said the name of the company. We're not don't want to release
Yeah,
that too soon. They still need us. But what do you think the biggest misunderstanding is about what we do in recruitment or what you do?
I've thought about this so many times.
Yeah.
I think there's two sides to this. So there's clients or potential clients, and then there's candidates. The candidate one's easier because everyone gets this. As soon as you say, I work in recruitment, it doesn't matter what sector someone works in. If you're at a party, someone sends you their CV, and you know, they might be a chef in high-end restaurants, and you're like, sorry, I can't help you. But even within your sector,
Yeah.
there's only so much, particularly for a firm like ours that specializes in kind of retained mandates, there's only so much we can do to help. Because yes, we've got a good network, but our clients respect us because we don't just send them CVs. That's not what we do. We don't just fish up loads of CVs and resumes and profiles and then just spam them out to people. That is what a lot of people do. That's not what good firms do. So we're probably not the best route for you to sort of find a new role if you're proactively doing it, or if you're or if you're made redundant. Now, that's not to say we can't, and we really do, but you have to have that very niche specialist skill set, and you have to be, you know, top end, top 10% talent. And that is not, that's a really hard thing to one quantify, but it's also a really hard thing to kind of say, because it sounds like, oh, we're not interested in trying to help you, but there's a misunderstanding there of what our job is. Our job is to find the square peg for the square hole that our client has asked us to find. It is not to then suggest a triangle-shaped peg for a hole that doesn't exist, you know? Terrible analogy, but you know, I hope the kind of point remains. So I think sometimes there's a misunderstanding there because I think people from disappointed and think, well, they weren't that helpful. I'll always help someone review a resume. I'll always give someone advice. And I'll always, if I've got really close contact, it's nothing to me to pick up the phone and go, look, if you were hiring, is there anything coming up on your slate that would fit someone like this? But there's a lot of caveats to that because I am what I represent. And if my clients are asking for that, essentially, I'm just sending them kind of, I'm just piling their desk with resumes that they don't need and actually forcing them into a bit of a quandary sometimes. So I think that's the biggest misunderstanding from a candidate perspective. And I hate talking candidates, clients, but yeah, everyone's people. I get that. But let's just for the sake of this conversation, from a client perspective, we're just really unfortunate, right? We work in an industry which has a lot of bad actors, like a load of bad actors. And I particularly think this about, I think the biggest misunderstanding is about kind of retained work versus non-retained work, really. Or why you should, put your eggs in one recruitment basket. So pick one firm to work with exclusively. There seems to be, and I've heard this phrase like a lot more. This comes a lot more from kind of relatively new business owners, business starters, entrepreneurs, is that why would I put all my eggs in one basket where I can cover more ground by going with multiple recruitment providers? Well, firstly, we won't work with you. So there's like, and that doesn't mean that you're not going to fill your mandate. It's just that, no, that's just the way we work. And, unfortunately, then we probably won't work with you. But if you're genuinely working with a specialist, and it's very easy to find out, ask them who their last clients are, ask them for references, and ask them what sort of roles they fill, and ask them to evidence that. I don't know why people don't do that. It's what you would do if you were hiring someone, and effectively you're outsourcing to us. Well, why wouldn't you ask us for references, roles we've filled, and kind of our client list, and we would happily provide that for you. Like, so once you've got past that, if I'm genuinely a specialist, what ground do you think multiple people are going to cover? And if you pay for our time, we will do that for you. And I think that's the other thing that it's what we're doing. No one has a magic wand. Everyone's got databases, but they're only so unique. Everyone has a network, but if that person is in that sector and specializes in the sector, it's really as good as their tenure in that sector. So yes, mine's good, but it's going to be better than someone that's been doing it 2 years. But really, you're paying for time. But could you do this yourself? Probably. If I gave you the tools that we have, you could probably do it yourself, but it takes a lot of time. And so you are paying for the time. So when we say, oh, you multiple, why would I work on something that is not certain on the outcome? Because what business works like that? But that is about there's an expectation that people have these unique sets of sort of candidates that come out of nowhere, and largely they don't. So I think that's the biggest common misconception. And just to add, there is one last thing I add, that it's all about the money. And of course, you do it for fees. But I think that's it's kind of everyone knows that people aren't motivated purely by money. And like you can do well in the recruitment industry or the headhunting industry. There's a lot of businesses that you can earn a lot more money in, hedge funds, banking. And like most of the people I work with, yourself included, have got great degrees. I mean, you were a lawyer, right? You qualified as a lawyer. You probably earn more money being a corporate lawyer. We enjoy the job. The best people, yeah, we probably shouldn't bring that up. The best people are doing it because they love doing the job and they love helping businesses along. And yes, they want to earn money out of it. But the idea that you're just doing it for a quick buck, I think is ludicrous. It's just there's easier ways to make a living. So if you're going to be in this for 17 years, if you're just doing it for money, I think the idea that people would think that is, I understand it and I understand it because you see some of the behavior, but I think it's kind of it's a really simplistic view because there's just simply it's a lot better ways to make money than there is the recruitment industry. It's just too hard.
No, totally agree from the candidate side and the client side is just really interesting on my side with them, particularly I think there's so much I think with your space and sales and go-to-market leaders within insurance. It's so specific that they really have to lean on you heavily for that. But certainly in the world of tech, it is something more so in 2023 that I noticed where there can be six, seven, eight recruitment agencies all looking for the same people in the same area. So it does just beg the question, why not go with one company and do your due diligence, as you rightfully said, you know, ask for references, ask for previous track records, etc., etc. But you know, you mentioned something that or a phrase that I always love in terms of the recruitment being the bellwether of the economy, is a bit of a wrap up on 2023. Like, what do you feel that for you signaled for the whole of 2023? Like, what's your kind of main takeaways?
Yeah, well, I'm pleased that when everyone's doing their out this year, in this year, out this year,
Yeah.
out is just 2023. Like 2023 could just get in the bin. It was just a tough year, and I think I consistently got asked how I thought the insurtech state of the insurtech industry was in 2023, and I was bullish about it. There were funds that were just not fully deployed. There were people talking about raising new funds. Well, if you're raising new funds, that money has to be deployed. So there is going to be investment in good ideas. Now, I have massive empathy for people that raised in, 21, 22, and the valuations got cast adrift. But a lot of these businesses that were showing good progress got follow-on rounds. So it was just a different investment environment. I think if we look at, look at our performance, we were pretty flat. We did as well really as the year before, and that's never sort of a bad thing, but it's not great. And so I talked last year, and I used a cricket analogy, which didn't really transact as we have mostly a US kind of following. But cricket analogy, I was hitting singles, net no fours and sixes. Baseball analogies, we were getting on base, but there were no home runs, and it was just hard. And I think there was clearly an air of fear. There was an air of kind of trepidation. So what I found was that where there was a three-step process, it became a six-step process, and it became a six-step process on the fly. And it seemed like people were cautious and concerned about making decisions and hiring decisions. Roles got pulled. People were aggressively going over the contract of like between external suppliers. So there was a much more kind of microscopic look at, and it just reflects the grow at all costs. We're sitting here, what are we, not even 2 weeks into the new year, and we're looking at like Hyper Exponential raising Series B at 73 million, dollars. We're looking at companies like Rainbow raising 12 million for, restaurant specific MGA, and then I know it's more complex than that, but these are quite big round sizes for businesses at the size. I mean, it was a very big round for Hyper Exponential, and that's an incredible business. But there, that's a bit of an outlier. But the rounds have got bigger, the investments are coming back. We're hearing about people closing rounds, new rounds now. The size of those rounds are yet to be announced, which will be a bit more of a bellwether. But I would say that's the kind of like overarching macro view. On a kind of more micro level, what's getting investment? Much more traditional insurance plays. So when we talk about what insurtech is, we're seeing lots of digital MGAs, we're seeing digital agencies. And I think that's a kind of natural conclusion in that. The problem that we try to outrun the valuation metrics of a traditional insurance business with companies like Lemonade. So we were sold, or the public was sold them like a SaaS valuation, but you can't outrun a loss ratio. So it's just a correction. So what I think we're seeing is just we're seeing more businesses that are almost traditional insurance businesses. But interestingly, they're being venture backed. Now, my question is, are they venture scalable? That's not for me to decide. The venture community is deciding that they are. Are they great businesses? 100%. You can this it's less so in the UK, but in the US, this most insurance fortunes, I would say, on a kind of independent level have been made by broking and MGA businesses that have later been sold. So I think it's a great route to go down. And the other thing, finally, that I'll see is that there's just a continuation of much more discrete solutions being successful. And what I mean by that is that less of the kind of like broad, this is a SaaS platform for X part of the industry that covers everything, and more, this is an analytics tool that works specifically in property, and those businesses are getting funded and being successful because they're tackling a known problem. It's quite discreet, and they're doing it better than the competition. Those businesses seem to be performing well. But again, are they venture scalable? That's not a question I can answer. But those are the sort of trends that we're seeing. Those are the businesses that we're working with now, which is always a reflection of how where the money's being spent.
Yeah, I'm super interested to see what 2024 brings in terms of that niche focus within where people are going to innovate. So yeah, 2023 is in the bin. As a final question, more related to 2024, and so you mentioned some positivity around Hyper Exponential and Rainbow and some positive noise at the beginning of the year. Like, how do you feel scaling companies can set themselves up for hiring success in 2024 and maybe try and avoid the mistakes that were made in 2023?
This question, and no one ever listens to me. But I'll give my 17 years worth on this unload. Recruitment's about process, really. It's about people and process, but it's about process more than anything. And as much as people don't like that, that's just true. You need to have rigor in what you're doing and everything that you're doing if you really want to scale. Talent and talent attraction is a core function of your business, whether you like it or not. You know, the classic thing is, oh, how much do you spend on recruitment? Nothing. Oh, we source it all ourselves. Well, that's not nothing. That's your time. It's a bit like us saying podcasts are free. They're not free. You and I are sitting here for an hour. You know, we've had to buy equipment. There's been planning that's gone into that, and that's just us. So, you know, the idea that it's free is just simply not true. So really, it's about who do you want to attract? And having a plan and a pipeline, because by the time you want to hire them, you should know who those people are. So I would say have a process in place for attracting talent. And that needs to be not just a kind of like ideology, it needs to be a kind of like practical methodology. So let's say that you want to address the representation of people of color in your business. What are you doing about that? Where's your outreach into that? Where are you building communities of talent? Same could be said for addressing kind of gender imbalances. You know, go and find proactively. There's a lot of proactivity that has to be happened. Take a look at your employer brand. Are you representing the company and what you do? Great, but what's it like to work at your business? Is there enough visibility of that? Are you on enough podcasts? Do you allow your people to kind of build their own brand on LinkedIn? Are you making kind of heroes of the people within your business by getting them on stages at conferences at ITI or ITC? There's a lot there that you can do that drives attraction, and then have a good process. You know, have a process for evaluating what salaries are out there. Speak to people like us, look at kind of what's out in the marketplace. You need to benchmark your salaries. Then you kind of need to kind of go, right, this is how we're going to do it ourselves. We need an internal process for that. And it needs to be set in stone. It can't be you start at a three-stage process that becomes a six-stage process. If you can't find them yourselves, who are you going to work with? Build relationships with recruitment companies that you like and trust. Obviously, we're here for business all day long, but it might not be us. You might have people ask for ideas within your business. Do they feedback in? Interview those people ahead of time. Interview people like us. What have we done? What are we good for? Where can we help you? And then, if you've got a timeline of when you need this person to start, work back from and get external advice. If you need this person to start in June, then you better be thinking about it now. So it's more having process and structure in place. And to be honest, it's taking external advice. You take external advice on almost everything. It's an arrogant, naive thing to think that you kind of know the best steps, even if you've done it before, because the talent market is continuously changing. What people want is continuously changing. What evolves is things like compensation, people's kind of like needs and wants. And you need to be on top of that all the time. But The biggest thing is make it core. Like it's part of having a value structure. You, when business says, oh, these are our values, it's because it's close to the core of what they believe. Talent attraction needs to be part of the core of what you believe and a methodology attached to that. Otherwise, you've got no chance of scaling successfully.
Well, that brings us to the end of the show, and that was great. A lot of fun being the host on here, but Pat, we covered a lot of ground, and yeah, it's been great.
Thanks, Gavin. Yeah, it's the most nervous I've been doing this show. So thanks for being a great host on my podcast.
Anytime, anytime.
Thanks, Paul.